the most horrifying thing about that image isn't the chair and it isn't the hood. It's the moment when the staff walk away and leave that kid alone with whatever he's struggling with. Because anyone who knows a child knows that when kids are struggling at that age, what they need is connection. And incarceration, by definition, severs connection.
Nell Bernstein is a San Francisco-based journalist who focuses on the US prison system. She's also author of the book Burning Down the House, which investigates her country's juvenile detention centres. So what came to mind for her when she saw the footage from the Northern Territory?
Two things come to mind. American juvenile detention and juvenile prisons come to mind because we use things like restraint chairs and tear gas and solitary confinement and throwing kids naked into cold cells on a regular basis. But I have to say, looking at the images from Australia, the spit hood is new to me, and I would guess I'm not the first to say that the first thing that came to mind was Abu Ghraib.
Absolutely. That analogy has been made repeatedly here in Australia. So as far as you understand, spit hoods are not being used in juvenile prisons or juvenile detention centres in the USA.
Perhaps we haven't come up with that particular twist, but I could be wrong. I'm consistently surprised at my capacity to discover new horrors within these systems.
This has been a huge story in Australia. Presumably there have been similar revelations in the USA in recent years. Can you tell me about some of them?
For us, this isn't new. In the time that I've spent researching juvenile prisons, primarily the last 10 years, I can't count the number of cycles I've seen that look like the one you're about to go through in Australia, which is some footage is released to the media. Maybe it's guards setting dogs on non-resistant young men, or a brutal beating by guards, or somebody being strip searched and thrown into a cold cell, tear gas being applied directly to somebody's eyes. These images come out. We're shocked. We express our shock in the media and at various levels of government. We form committees and enough blue ribbon commissions to keep the blue ribbon industry going, and yet it doesn't stop. So unfortunately, if you were to ask me the prognosis, I would guess you're entering one of those cycles.
What are the elements of an effective response and an effective reform when these revelations come to light? And I'm hoping that there have been some successful processes in the USA that you can point to.
We have had one great success, and that is that we have actually reduced the number of kids behind bars by 50% since its height in the mid-90s. And that is the only thing I've come across that really protects kids from abuse in these facilities. As I was looking at the coverage of what was happening in Australia, I came across something by a prison administrator saying, you know, these are violent, dangerous places. This kind of stuff is necessary and inevitable. And I'm afraid I agree with him. When you take a bunch of kids, many of whom have experienced a lot of trauma already, isolate them from everything and everyone that they've ever known, and put them in an enclosed environment together with a group of poorly trained, in most cases underpaid, adults who are afraid of them but have total power over them, you have a recipe for abuse. I actually don't think that you can have that kind of an institution and not see incidents like the ones that are now being revealed in Australia.
But surely things can be made better if you have transparency, if you have governance, if you have better trained people in these all-powerful roles, as you point out, and better physical facilities. Surely there can be changes made to the architecture, the legal architecture, the human resources architecture, and the physical architecture.
Sure, but it's not going to stop the abuse. I wish that I could feel as hopeful as you do. But I've been inside therapeutic facilities. I've been inside facilities with really dedicated, forward-thinking administrators. I've been inside places that look like Ivy League colleges. And some or all of these things happen in all of them. This particular place I'm thinking of, which was really lovely, ivy-covered walls, green lawns, the kids were putting together care packages to send to the third world. The administrator let two young men show me around the place. And as they gave me a tour, I walked past classrooms with motivational posters and the isolation wing, which both of these guys had been in early in their stay, as had everybody else, you know, which is solitary confinement, which I don't know how where you're at with that exactly, but the United Nations has determined that any amount of time in solitary confinement constitutes torture for juveniles. Yet every facility uses it, whether they use that term or not. I'm sorry, because I think this isn't maybe what you wanted to hear. I don't think there is a set of reforms that can make an institution that is intrinsically damaging abuse-free.
So what are you suggesting? I mean, we're talking here about children who, I don't know the circumstances of all of them, and certainly there are huge questions around the criminal justice system in the Northern Territory, but some of these kids are very highly challenging, very difficult, and have committed serious offences, some of them.
So that's the question. What do you do with the kid who is dangerous? And I certainly don't want to be a Pollyanna on that front. But one thing I would say is that I've interviewed hundreds of kids and had long friendships with others. By the time a kid gets to this kind of serious crime, he has cycled in and out of juvenile halls and juvenile prisons since he was 10 or 11 or 12, often starting with something very small, suffering more trauma and increasing in violence. So I think we have to think, if we really want to answer that question, we can't just look at the kid who did the worst thing in an isolated way. We have to ask what happened at our first opportunity to intervene with him. Because there are programs that work, and I think that they're even used in Australia, like multisystemic therapy or functional family therapy, where even kids who have committed very serious offenses are not taken out of their communities. Instead, if it's safe for them to be in their family, they and their family get a dedicated social worker and works not only with the kid but with the family, because if there are family problems and you don't address them, removing the kid and sending him back isn't really going to do anything. So it's not that I don't think there are interventions that are useful. There are. They just rarely involve the kind of institutions that I think we're talking about. And most kids that are locked up, even in higher-end facilities, are there for really quite low-level offenses.
This idea of what is the appropriate use of force, that I assume is also a burning question in the USA.
Yeah, and especially this issue of self-harm. There was a young woman I interviewed who told me that her roommate had been talking about feeling suicidal, and the response of the guards was to send the equivalent of a SWAT team into the cell, drag her out, strip her naked, and put her in a cold cell, which is another technique that's used to break terrorism suspects. It's bare, cold cell with nothing but tiles and a drain. So did that reduce the chance that she would harm herself? Maybe in that instance, although a larger proportion of successful suicides take place in isolation cells than anywhere else. So it's kind of a fallacious argument to begin with. But did that increase the chance that she would not want to live moving forward? Of course it did. If my kid were at risk of harming himself, would I go out and buy a restraint chair, put him in that chair, put a hood over his head so he didn't spit at me, and then close the door and leave him there? I mean, it's almost laughable. We would hold our kids close if we felt that they were at risk of harming themselves. And to me, the most horrifying thing about that image isn't the chair and it isn't the hood. It's the moment when the staff walk away and leave that kid alone with whatever he's struggling with. Because anyone who knows a child has ever, you know, been a parent or been a child knows that when kids are struggling at that age, what they need is connection. And incarceration, by definition, severs connections. And then when you respond to acting out by extreme severance of connections, there's just no question that you're endangering those kids, not protecting them.
Have there been many prosecutions and have there been many civil actions by children and their families when these sorts of incidents have become public?
No. The impunity that a prison guard has in this country is stunning. For example, we have a high incidence of sexual abuse of juveniles by guards. That's about 10%. That's just by guards. We have a special law, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, meant to reduce the already illegal practice of raping children in your care. And yet it continues. And I could count on two hands the number of times I've heard of even a verified instance of sexual abuse leading to the prosecution of a guard. The worst case scenario is that maybe that guard will be transferred. There's not a lot of room in our civil system to sue successfully if your kid is killed, which happens with appalling frequency. You may have a shot at a civil lawsuit. On the other hand, the Justice Department here is constantly suing state systems. In California, where I live, the whole system was put under federal receivership because of not only abuse, but overcrowding and abysmal health care and all kinds of other conditions. So we do have the capacity to do that. But, you know, it got to the point where the federal government was holding the state in contempt again and again and again. And eventually, the state's response was to let the vast majority of the kids out. In California, we've gone from 10,000 kids in our state system to a few hundred over the course of the last decade. And I think that's because they were not able to resolve these problems with the population that they had. And that goes back to my sense that reform has to be much deeper than putting a new coat of paint on a dungeon.
So there aren't many cases of civil actions involving, say, excessive use of force, as opposed to sexual assault or, in the worst case scenario, the death of a child?
There have been more civil suits when a child dies, including there have been a number of deaths from medical neglect recently. I think the problem is it becomes hard, or it seems hard, for the courts to decide what is excessive force, because you hear he was a danger to himself, he was a danger to others. For example, in New York, where there were a series of scandals and revelations, there were kids who were being put in restraints that broke their ribs or chipped their teeth, or in one case, I think a kid did suffocate, and it turned out the infractions that were leading to these restraints were things like taking an extra cookie or laughing at a guard. There's a lot of latitude inside a juvenile or adult prison facility, which makes accountability not impossible, but challenging.
In the Northern Territory, we're talking about Indigenous children being locked up at the alarming rates that they are. What's the profile in the USA of kids behind bars?
The juvenile prison population skews overwhelmingly towards young people of color. That's African American and Latino kids mostly. And I looked really closely at that data because I think that it's very easy to assume that that's the case because that's who's committing crime. And here in the United States, that really doesn't hold up. There is a significant disparity in how we respond to kids of different races and classes, from whose neighborhood is patrolled by police to who gets stopped by police, who gets searched by police, whether police bring a kid home to his parents for, say, marijuana possession, or bring him down to the station. Then when we get to the courts, the sentences are different. When it comes time for parole and probation, there's a difference there. The racial implications are overwhelming, and I think it's really important when we talk about them not to take them for granted as just an act of God, but really look at how that came to be so.
U.S. investigative journalist Nell Bernstein and her book Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Detention, is published by New Press. That's the Law Report for this week. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and also to technical producer this week, Carey Dell. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law. It's time to break the cycle.